Okay, so a very brief recap of Monday. We covered a whole bunch of topics that really delved into techniques and technologies, obviously, with mass spec. And we talked quite a bit about protein-protein interactions and different ways that we could investigate those with genetic and biochemical approaches, but with a lot of proteomics laced in and mass spectrometry laced in. For the reason that, you know, this course is about computational methods, dealing with large data sets, large data. And, you know, the purpose of my lectures is to give you, and also with Dr. Noonan's lectures, was to give you an idea of where this data is coming from that will hopefully tie into many of the other topics that you'll cover later in the course. So we left off with protein-protein interactions, and I took you in greater detail into what I thought was an exemplary study of how this piece of biology is being addressed in mammalian systems, specifically in human systems, in that example. But to call your attention to some databases and biorepositories that exist on protein-protein interactions. There are several different sites. This is one particularly good one that tries to pull together information from many, many different types of repositories and integrate it all. And I just have been, as I've been teaching this course and thinking about it, have been sort of plotting the growth of this one particular one, the Mint database. So this is just the growth from 2011 to 2012, a couple days ago. And it's really impressive to see that, you know, the number of protein-protein interactions is going quickly increasing. So 150,000 different interactions have been described. And also the proteins that are in there, the ones that have actually been described in these, it's also growing. So this is, you know, as a unique protein is identified in a complex, it's growing and growing. So I think that this rate of change also relates to the advances in the technologies and the methodologies to pull out large complexes of proteins and many, many types, different types of complexes, like in the Harper study that we discussed. So I don't know. I mean, maybe 10 years we'll be able to really plot this rate of change and see if we start to plateau, but so far it's rapid. So to this point, we've discussed ways to obviously dive into some important types of biology, but we've really been talking about finding parts lists and assembling some order from a biological system. So I have this sort of analogy of like a clock where if you're just presented with a big pile of parts and you could design a study that you might figure out how these parts interact with each other and assemble, you get this static picture, right? What do these parts assemble into? But you're kind of missing something to really learn about the function, okay? And you would like to understand something about the dynamics of the system. So static pictures are great. There's no question that we learn a lot from mapping, but we really want to have dynamical information because that's where we start to really learn more information about function. So the example here, if you were to see how the system works over time, you would notice that it keeps time like a clock. So a powerful method that has been introduced, you know, almost from the beginning of proteomics, so this, I showed you this decade-long progress, has really been how to address the same information but quantitatively, so we can learn something more about dynamics and also learn something about the amounts, stoichiometry. There's a long list of why quantitation would be important in a proteomic experiment. So here's this workflow that we presented, that we discussed, digesting proteins, separating them, cataloging peptide ions, and sequencing peptide ions. And these are complex spectra. And what I want to just highlight here is if we can imagine that this is one protein, and each triangle is a different peptide liberated from those proteins. So in general, you don't get quantitative information from this type of experiment because there are many, many different factors that go into the intensity of any particular ion species. So you could have an equal molar amount of proteins or a mixture, and you would get a variety of intensities. So we need to have methods to get around this technical limitation to really learn something about quantitation, and certainly at an absolute level, right? So that's what I'm going to present to you, is ways that this same workflow is leveraged to be truly quantitative and get around this problem with that's inherent to max mass spec data. So there's the shotgun method, which we went over, but there's another one that I'll touch on that's, it's technical, and it has a lot to do with the type of mass spectrometer, but I think it's important because it's more and more is coming up in the literature, and if you go into this type of research yourself or you interact with the literature, you're going to come across this type of quantitation. And we can illustrate it simply by thinking of it the same, we access the information the same way, proteins and mixtures, digest them to peptides, resolve them, and measure them. But the mass spectrometer involved in this type of targeted proteomics works a little differently, and that is, here is a, this is a schematic of something that's happening inside the mass spec. And the details aren't really important, but let's just imagine that here's our mixture of peptides. So this is, let's say, it's a protein that's digested. Here's five different peptides. So the first process is to isolate one individual peptide ion to measure, okay? So unlike a shotgun experiment where it's, we're just collecting everything that comes through and trying to isolate and sequence everything we can super, super fast to build a giant list, this is a targeted approach where in the beginning, a particular ion of interest, a peptide of interest, is selected, okay? Then that peptide is fragmented. So again, just like in a shotgun experiment where peptide is isolated, fragmented, and then those fragments tell you something about the sequence. That same process is used to fragment the peptide into pieces, and then an individual piece is isolated as an ion and measured. So what you get is this progression of reactions, isolation, fragmentation, isolation, and you get a signal that's derived from that. And so if you think about it, you can derive a signal, and you can get sequence information, all right? So if you do many of these peptide fragments, you get the same type of sequence information that you get from a shotgun experiment. So you get specificity, identity, and this can be used for quantitation, okay? So it's a powerful technique that has been applied in an increasingly number of different ways to creatively get into quantitative information in proteins and proteomes. So a concept that I just talked about was that, so the mass spec data itself is not inherently quantitative, okay? There's some technical limitations there, but as I just alluded to, there's some tricks that can get around that. So while if you were to just digest a protein or a protein complex, and we were just talking about many studies that have pulled out protein complexes, digested them, and identified all the proteins in that complex, okay? You were just simply to do that, you wouldn't necessarily get quantitative information directly from those signals. But there's an interesting property. That is, the number of peptides observed from a given protein complex or a protein sample tends to correlate to the amount of the protein that's in the sample. Okay? So here's an example. This is from my own research, but it just shows the point. So let's take a complicated large protein complex like that exists on the membrane of red blood cells. There's a lot of proteins of high abundance that scaffold the entire cell. If you just take this protein mixture and run it out on a gel, okay, this is just an SDS page gel, and stain it. So here's simple proteomics right there. There's a picture of the membrane proteome from that cell, okay? You can immediately see that the intensity of the Kamasi stain correlates to the amount of protein that's in the sample. So here are a bunch of really abundant proteins that are much and far greater than some of the lighter and less abundant proteins that are in the sample. If you take the same sample and digest it up and shoot it on the mass spec, so if we sit here and look and use low resolution visual proteomics, let's say we see about 16 bands. But if we do a really high content shotgun experiment, we can see something like 242 different proteins from the same sample. So obviously we got more resolution. But we can also see something interesting that right here I've just tabulated the number of unique peptides that we've identified and sequenced from those proteins. And you'll see that that number correlates to the abundance of the protein. So the big fat bands in the gel, the most abundant proteins in the sample, have a lot more identified peptides. And this is termed sometimes, this is one way to illustrate it, but you'll see a term called spectral counting, or a method to count the number of peptides, count the number of observations in a mass spec experiment. And the Nature paper that we discussed from Harper's group, where they dissected autophagy, they used a spectral counting method to identify the proteins of high abundance in those complexes and to learn in a little bit more detail the composition of those complexes. And spectral counting has been a really powerful way to add quantitation to proteomics, and especially in protein complexes, where you might want to understand what are the most abundant proteins. Can we determine, even if it's at low resolution, some of the stoichiometry involved? 10 copies of this, 5 copies of this, in a relative abundance way. Many, many high copy proteins in a particular stoichiometry that make up this really important biological complex. And that can be gleaned from a shotgun experiment, but there's limitations. But it's certainly used a lot, and you'll come across that in your reading. But there's been other methodologies that are much more quantitative. They're more sensitive, they have much more dynamic range, and they have really become now mainstream in becoming really truly quantitative in proteomics experiments. And this one I wanted to go through in some detail because it really transformed quantitative proteomics. And it's a method called SILAC, stable isotope labeling with amino acids in cell culture. So simply put, imagine a cell, let's say it's a mammalian cell, growing in media, and that media has normal amino acids in it. Normal amino acids have your standard isotopic abundance, okay? Isotopes are important because this is what makes up the atoms in a molecule, right, in amino acids. So normal amino acids have a defined mass. But this technique does something pretty cool. It introduces heavy labeled amino acids. These are not radioactive amino acids. These are amino acids that are enriched in heavier isotopes of carbon and of nitrogen. And so what happens is, what I've illustrated here is this lysine backbone has the normally abundant carbon 12. But these cells are grown with highly enriched purified carbon 13 based lysine. So there's 6 carbons per lysine molecule. So every single lysine has a mass shift of 6, okay? Mass spectrometers just measure mass, right? So that's a really powerful way of separating something by just its mass. And by introducing it as an amino acid, it's even simpler. Every cell takes up that amino acid. Every single protein that's in that cell is labeled heavy. So you've basically shifted an entire organism, a cell in this case, into a heavy labeled state. Now it's simple. You just do your same shotgun proteomics. You can take 2 different conditions, isolate the peptides, mix them in a predefined ratio, and then ask the question, how does abundance change across all these peptides that we're observing? So you can see differences in the ratio, okay? Very simple, very clever, and transformative for proteomics. And so right down here at the bottom, here's our decade tour of proteomics in yeast. There's been a few really good papers, but this one in particular was a study that compared haploid and diploid yeast using the SILAC approach. And we're going to go into detail in a second. So that's this approach I just described, labeling 2 different types of yeast and looking across the entire proteome and asking, how do protein abundances change? So quantitative proteomics, whole proteome. And another study that came out shortly afterwards that used this targeted proteomics approach. And what they did that was really clever and powerful was, here I described a way that an entire cell and every protein derived from that cell is labeled and it's distinct in the mass spec. In this study, they synthesized peptides. So you can incorporate the same type of heavy amino acids into synthetic peptides. And so if you know what type of peptide you want to study from a living cell or from a biological system, you can spike in an internal standard And because, again, the difference is mass, they're chemically identical. The amino acid sequence is the same. The R groups are exactly the same. They're just different in mass. You get a distinct species. And you can compare the synthetic peptide and make an internal standard so you can do real quantitation on your analyte of interest, right? The native protein. So synthetic standard, native protein. Here you have two populations that are biologically relevant that you compare simultaneously. So these two types of approaches were applied globally for yeast. And the Silex study, it was pretty impressive. I mean, they did a lot of really aggressive, high throughput, lots and lots of mass spec runs. But in the end, and this is just right out of the paper, they compared their proteome coverage. So what are the proteins we observed with high confidence? They compared it to the TAP-TAG study that we talked about, the study that just tagged all the open reading frames in yeast and pulled them all out and started cataloging which of these genes are expressing proteins. So that's a way to look at the whole proteome of yeast. Or the GFP study, where they hooked a GFP reporter up to all the open reading frames in yeast. And so the mass spec, which is here nano-LC-MS, they identified almost the same number of expressed proteins. So they really captured the whole proteome. And so now you have three different methods that really observed and measured something interesting about the entire proteome of yeast. And they also did something interesting. They were able to show that with their mass spec results and the way that they and the way that you identify peptides and the way you're certain of the protein you're looking at, they had a much, much lower false discovery rate. So they were certain that these peptides came from these proteins from this organism. And it was actually higher than some of the false discovery rates that came with the tagging. So maybe like you accidentally tagged the wrong protein, or you're not 100% sure that the protein you tag is actually hooked up to the ORF. So there was some false discovery rates in the prior two studies. So that was pretty impressive. And then this, just a snapshot from this study, which was pretty cool, is what they did is they wanted to show that they could quantitate proteins in a cell, that they could report a copy number from the most abundant protein in the cell. So something like, this is log 2, right? So 1 to the 6 copies per cell, all the way down to 100 or less copies per cell. So they had complete control of the dynamic range of the actual number of molecules per cell. So that's absolute quantitation, all right? And that's what the targeted approach afforded. So this is just a big snapshot of the data from the Silex study, where since they were comparing haploid diploid yeast, okay? So yeast can exist with two different states of its whole genome. And what they were interested in, so what were the differences? Could we really tease out what is globally different in all the expressed proteins? And so all these dots in red, so what you should know is that obviously the majority of the proteins are expressed at similar levels, okay? You're not gonna have huge shifts. I mean, a yeast is a yeast. Haploid, diploid, they're essentially the same organism. But there's some important pathways that are enriched in a haploid versus diploid, and these were the mating pathways. So all the pathways that control mating, which is a programmed response. If a cell is diploid, it doesn't need to mate, but if it's haploid, it needs to mate. And so this is just this systematic view of the proteins that were upregulated in a haploid. So it was primed for mating, and you wouldn't see that. So the whole proteome comparing two different cells with Silex teased out some biological differences, okay? Nothing necessarily earth-shattering about what they learned, but it was proof that you could quantitate and do an experiment with an entire proteome on an organism. And the MRM study looked at the carbon cycle, and they were interested in how you could get dynamic flux of proteins in an entire system as you looked at different time points. So looking at, you know, what you might normally see as doubling time or growth phase for the yeast, instead let's track proteins along the primary carbon cycle, so looking at glucose utilization, and track fold changes across all those different proteins to show that you can do systematic discovery in a dynamic setting in a cell. So this, I thought this is such a cool study, and I'm just gonna touch on it for a second because again, it just gives you one of those huge snapshots of a whole proteome, and it just drives home the point of what you can accomplish with this labeling method. So this study the Amon group has long been interested in how aneuploidy, so multiple copies of chromosomes, is relevant in cancer phenotypes, and there's a whole body of literature on this. But what they did is they were interested in trying to force yeast cells to have disomies at one particular chromosome. And then they wanted to ask the question, how is this controlled? So they used a SILAC approach, so they could introduce disomy at a single chromosome and look and see how the entire proteome was reacting to that situation. And so this is just a SILAC experiment. Again, you have the disomic or the wild type. This is just wild type versus wild type. So it's obviously everything's one-to-one. It's very normalized. But then here is disomy at chromosome 5. And what you're plotting is all of the proteins in the proteome across all the chromosomes in yeast. And what do you think that blip is? It's chromosome 5. So if you have disomy at chromosome 5, you see the appropriate upregulation of all the ORFs on that particular chromosome. So showing you, you know, proteome-wide resolution, a predictable stoichiometry based on the genetic context of the cell, played out perfectly in the proteome and revealed with SILAC. And of course, they found some cool stuff that violated this rule, and that's the paper, but I wanted to just point that out. So another exciting realm that certainly has been enabled by SILAC and other approaches for quantitation is to study not just protein expression, but post-translational modifications. So in this example, let's say it's signaling. So a protein is phosphorylated, and that's key to understanding if it's on or off or how its state changes in a cell. It has nothing to do with the genome, DNA or RNA. It's all protein, and it's all post-translational. So a SILAC approach, let's imagine that these peaks now in the mass spec are phosphorylated peptides. And you could look at the difference in a phosphorylated peptide with SILAC approach and learn something about how it's changing. And that particular field, the field of phosphoproteomics, was really changed by a technology that was very simple but powerful, which allowed people doing this type of work to take, again, here we have this concept of the whole proteome digested in a tube. That mixture of peptides, we had a medium that would enrich for phosphopeptides. So you throw out everything else and you just looked at the phosphopeptide complement of a cell or a protein complex. And so you could reveal just the phosphopeptides and you could start measuring them. So another really powerful aspect, again, here's this shotgun proteomics, shotgun mass spectrometry type workflow. Intact peptide, first mass spec, fragmentation, product ion spectra, MSMS. But let's say you had a modified amino acid. So in this case, a phosphoserine. Okay, or a phosphothreonine. Remember that these fragments distill down to the difference is the amino acid in the chain, right? So if you walk along these fragments, you could, let's pretend that it's aspartate, glutamate, threonine. Well, if you have a modified amino acid, that mass differs from an unmodified. So you're going to see a difference between a threonine or a phosphothreonine or any other modification. So not only can you deduce the sequence of a peptide, you can tell if it's modified. And so obviously this was leveraged to not only identify these are the sites in the proteome that are phosphorylated, but you could also figure out how they're changing by using a quantitative approach like SILAC. And this is a gory detail, but the point is that there are signatures that are easily discovered in this is again a product ion spectrum. This is a real one from this peptide. So here is a non-phosphopeptide, and it has this fragmentation. But when there's a phosphothreonine, the intact mass shifts by the weight of a phosphate, right? But then also, all along the product ion spectrum are signatures that speak to the fact that there's a threonine in there that's carrying a phosphate. And they light up, and they're easily identified, so that you get two completely different data sets, and that really nail down the type of modification and the localization in a peptide. It's extremely powerful for diving in. So we use this approach in our work to look at, and this is now going away from all whole-scale proteomics down to let's just look at one protein and ask a basic question, but We knew that phosphorylation was an on-off switch in this context. Okay, it's that simple. This protein, if it's phosphorylated, is off, or is off. And it's dephosphorylated, it's on. But we have no idea where that was. Where was it modified? It's got to be there. So use the mass spec, pull out the protein, find the phosphopeptide, map the site, then set up an experiment where you can look at two different states. Same protein. This state it's on, this state it's off. This state it's labeled with heavy labeled amino acid, this state it's not. And we look for differences. And so here's some of that data just plotted right out. So what we were looking for is non-phosphopeptides that didn't change. Okay, these should be one-to-one. Then we mapped a whole bunch of different phosphopeptides from that same protein. And the ones that were interesting, the ones that were modulated when the protein was on, should deviate in their Cilac ratio. We should see dynamics. And we did. We could see that two phosphorylation sites in totally different parts of the protein were coordinated, dephosphorylated, only when the protein was activated. Okay? So now that's like, you know, very extreme resolution on one protein that we thought was interesting and exciting. Okay? But now imagine if you did that same experiment but asked the question, how does a whole signaling network work? Right? What about a couple hundred, a couple thousand proteins that are all part of a signaling cascade? Kinase A phosphorylates substrate B, or a whole cascade of kinases, all initiated by a physiological stimuli, right? Where are the sites? What are the important proteins? How do they change over time? How do we visualize signaling inside of a cell? Okay, so enter quantitative phosphoproteomics, and this study that I've recommended for the class is really one of the, you know, the first in-depth and proof of principles that you can really do this and learn something about an entire signaling network in the same type of experiment. Now, you'll read in detail if you haven't already that they took this to another level, and they thought of all these clever different ways that you could use different Cilac labels, different heavy amino acids, mix it all up so they could get a lot more time points, a lot more resolution across, mix them all together, and then deconvolute the whole thing. But at the end of the day, you got a story about how receptors are signaling through an entire cascade all the way down to an interaction with the nucleus. So an entire important signaling cascade from a human cell. And they had more complicated Cilac pairs, but it's still the basic idea. Labeling the same peptide, it's phosphorylated, we look for changes. These are maybe about the same. This one's really different. So 1 minute after epidermal growth factor, something's changing, okay? Add it all up, sum it all together, and look for trends. So every single line here is a different phosphopeptide, which is, remembering that if it's a phosphopeptide, it's reporting something about that protein in the cell, okay? So you're looking at what's happening over time to this entire signaling cascade. And, you know, this is just a snapshot, but you can imagine that you could have events that happen later after EGF stimulation. So here's changes that are peaking 5 minutes after the receptor is stimulated. And then there's some that are even late shifted even more. But then you also have earlier events. So you have an acute response, maybe a more intermediate, long-term, chronic response to the same signaling event. And if you just broke open this cell and looked and asked, what are all the phosphorylation sites, you would never be able to reconstruct signaling across this pathway. It's static. But because we're looking at it in a dynamic system, we're using quantitation, you know, the biology comes out, the story comes out. Different categories of the signaling pathway emerge. So that is the end of the proteomics, protein part. We're going to shift gears incredibly and go into crystallography and protein crystallography and protein structure. So at this point, do you have any basic questions about the first 1.5 lectures? Crystal clear? Are you going to ace the quiz? Perfect. I did my job. You know it all now. Okay. All right. So the big asterisk here, this is not a structural biology course in a traditional sense, okay? We are not going to even be able to get close to understanding this field, this science, what it can do, how it's actually achieved, okay? I'm going to do my best to introduce some of the basic principles. If you've already had advanced crystallography, you're way ahead of us, okay? Congratulations. But maybe if you can suffer through some of the basics, you'll see that I'll try to connect it to this course, all right? And there's no question that the amount of structural data is increasing at a really exciting rate, that we are getting atomic level resolution of macromolecules, the same molecules that I just was discussing in protein-protein interactions, proteomics, the same types of molecules that are encoded in genes and genomes, okay? We are understanding what they look like when they're in complex, when they're in dynamic states, okay? That structural information is really powerful. There are now emerging and techniques that have emerged, many of them from Yale, about how you can use that information to maybe make predictions, to understand something about the structure and the function of a system, and maybe weave that back into a story about something bigger than one structure. So you would have to go into structural databases. You'd have to do data mining in the context of structural information. So it's important to understand where that comes from, okay? And I'm going to try to point out some of the limitations, okay? But only in a way that I think relates to putting it all together in the context of a course like this, where you're really trying to achieve something from a computational standpoint, from using a computational approach to understanding biology. So where are the limitations in understanding all of biology from a high-resolution molecular point of view, okay? So, right off the top, I have to thank two of my colleagues for contributing to this lecture, and I'm stealing extensively from their slides. And I recommend this course for a real in-depth and academic look and understanding of crystallography. And you have copies of these. These are some good resources, from the detailed just to the simple. I like this video. I mean, it takes like 15 minutes to watch, but it sort of takes you through the basics of like how do you set up a crystal and diffract it and all that stuff. And then Crystallography 101 and Crystallography Made Crystal Clear is a fantastic resource that many, many, many people have used over the years just to wrap their head around this field. So I recommend those. So we'll focus mostly on crystallography. So why is there an X-ray crystallography? Why are we talking about X-rays? Why do we have to, take this approach to understand any molecule at atomic resolution? Well, because it's atomic resolution, right? There's a limit to how small an object can be seen, obviously by your eye, but even with a light microscope, okay? If you're talking about a bond length that's below the limit of diffraction for normal light, you're not going to see that, okay? So this is just one of the basic ideas, is that you need X-rays to resolve atomic features, because you're trying to look at bond lengths. That's just, that you usually always talk about the carbon-carbon bond, 1.5 angstroms. So an X-ray source, even a basic one, can get you pretty close. You know, you have already a wavelength that's 1.5, and then we'll talk about what a synchrotron is and how that's even higher resolution X-ray sources. So now you're getting down to atomic level resolution in your mode of assay, okay? But then how is that done is the question. So here again is just sort of the idea of diffraction, right? So like light diffracts, we're looking at the property of an X-ray and how it diffracts, all right? And to try to simplify this down, not because I don't think you're able to think about a complicated concept, but we're trying to, put this all together in something that's understandable in 30 minutes instead of an entire semester or two semesters. You're imagining that you're hitting a molecule with X-rays, and we want to interpret the diffraction pattern. We're going to interpret that result, okay? and that's how it's done. And you may so this is my point at the lecture where I point out that X-ray crystallography is not the only way that you can get structural information from macromolecules. Okay, and there's a whole other realm using NMR. Again, it's how one detection method interacts with molecules and how you infer molecular identity from those data. Okay, NMR is clearly powerful and used quite a bit. But there's also electron microscopy. So this isn't light microscopy, it's electron microscopy. So it has atomic resolution, all right, different than light. And there's some other types of fluorescence and other types of energy resonance techniques that can be used to explore macromolecules. And they're all relevant and they're very powerful. But there has been much more success on a broad scale and at high resolution. And the bulk of structural information is coming from X-ray crystallography. So it's relevant to talk about that in detail. But it's also important to tell you that it's not the only way. And who knows, you know, in 10 years, something could leap over that. But for the moment, the databases are filled with X-ray crystallography data, and it's coming and coming and coming and coming. So we have to address that seriously. So this is the where does it all come from slide, okay? So we're talking about proteins right now, okay? We'll talk about nucleic acids in a minute, but let's imagine your favorite protein, you want to understand the atomic structure. So proteins can, on some scales, be synthesized chemically, but that's not typically how it's done. We're typically looking at biological proteins. So the origin is biological. It's basic protein synthesis, usually carried out in, here it's expression, but these are by and large bacterial cells that have recombinant DNA. Gene of interest makes protein of interest, makes a lot of it. You pull it out and purify it, that type of approach. So you're overexpressing a molecule of interest in a host. Bacteria are used, insect cells are used, and even human cells are used. Okay, but it's cellular based, all right? And what's really important, and this, you know, this is a lot, I mean, in some crystallography projects, this is the entire time spent. Is this part. It's just getting the sample that you want to crystallize. There's an enormous amount of challenges here. So I don't want to underrepresent this part of the craft, but eventually you have to get a pure substance, right? And we'll discuss that in a second, but that's really important to have a structure, to have a crystal. Okay, there has to be an element of purity. So going into this part, there's purification. Then there's the process of crystallization, which I'll show you in a moment in more detail. But for this slide, let's just say that a pure substance in a variety of different settings, which allows a crystallization of event to happen. Okay, so here's an example of a crystal that would form. And then this crystal has to be extracted and introduced into an X-ray source so that a diffraction pattern can be collected. So make the protein, crystallize the protein, hit it with X-rays, collect the data set, build a structure. And there's, we'll spend some time on this, there's a lot that goes into the refinement and interpretation of the X-ray diffraction pattern. So why crystals? Again, this is the, you know, the why do we use X-rays, why do we use scattering? But also, crystals are an ordered lattice, okay? That by definition, you have a pure substance that's highly ordered to generate a lattice that's repeated over and over and over and over again. So we don't look at one molecule in X-ray crystallography. We look at hundreds, thousands, maybe a million molecules, right, or more. But they're all ordered in a crystalline lattice, okay? And that is what is subjected to X-ray diffraction. So to make a crystal, all right, and I'm sure all of you have either done a basic experiment, maybe in elementary school, or some point where you crystallize sugar from a dense solution or table salt in water, same principles, right? If you have your solution that has a high enough concentration of your molecule of interest. If you get the water out, you get an increasing concentration of the solute, okay? And under the right conditions, you can stimulate an aggregation or a crystallization event. It's not just aggregation because that would be nonspecific, right? You don't want that. You want an ordered lattice. You want this crystallization event to be nucleated and expanded. And that is typically a function of how the water is extracted from the solution. So one important thing, you've got to have the protein in solution, all right? So maybe this would be a challenge. We'll talk about this later, but maybe that's a challenge to proteins that they don't like water, okay? Many proteins don't have affinity for water. They have affinity for polar substances like biological membranes, okay? So that's a challenge, right? Protein in solution, different modes to extract the water. You can just simply have evaporation from a hanging drop. This is your protein solution hanging over a reservoir, or maybe instead of on a drop, it's on a pedestal, or immersed in oil so that the water comes out. There's many, many different ways to do this. And now typically, it's also automated so that even more important than this design and the protein that you've plopped in your solution is the composition of that solution. So often, huge different chemical spaces are surveyed. Different companion molecules, different salts, different large, small organic additives that promote or help stabilize your protein, promote crystallization while continuing these processes. So there's a lot of screening involved. There's a lot of guess and test to get this event to occur. But then once it does, it's data collection time, okay? And so this is just probably really dated, but the basics are there. You have to have a way to suspend the crystal in air so that your X-ray source can be trained perfectly onto the crystal, diffraction patterns emerge, and then you have to have a detection. So this is the basic setup, and there's even setups like this on campus where you can take a crystal and get basic diffraction patterns and start your work. Now, as I pointed out very early on, there's a difference in the quality and the intensity, let's say, of your X-ray source. So an in-house X-ray source, or like one that you might have at, you know, the dentist's office or the doctor's office to take an X-ray, the quality is a little different. But when structural biologists need to have much higher quality, more powerful X-ray sources, they go to synchrotrons. And so here's some of the ones that do a lot of structural biology. And these are, you know, linear accelerators or different types of accelerator arrays for particle physics, for high energy particle physics, right? And many of these sources emit X-rays as byproducts. And so those are siphoned off and designated at maybe a little house next to the whole array where biologists come in and hook up their crystals and steal these really high quality X-ray sources to do crystallography. So synchrotrons are really, really important to the field. And once all the preliminary work is done and you understand you've got a good crystal and it diffracts, you head off yourself or ship it to a synchrotron to collect the real final data set and to get the resolution. So this is just an example of a diffraction pattern, okay? There's a lot more that goes behind this. We're skipping over this, right? The mathematics of diffraction, why these patterns emerge the way they do, why there's differences in intensities. So all this is all the information from the crystal. What's this thing, though? Does anybody know? This big artifact in the middle of the beautiful diffraction pattern? Were you paying attention? Yeah, that's the thing that holds the crystal, right? It's in the way. So you get that image. So they're always going to look like that. I'm not a crystallographer. I don't think that that's been solved in any clever way but they usually look like this for a raw image. If you ever even see this, because a lot of it's automated and it's shuttled off into a processing station. But this actually is an X-ray diffraction pattern. It's the most famous one ever. Does anyone know what it is? DNA. It's DNA. Right. It's Rosalind Franklin's DNA X-ray diffraction pattern. Was this a crystal? usually it's silence after that. That was not a crystal. They looked at fibrous, they looked at fibril formations of DNA at the time. So there was plenty of utility in diffracting X-rays off of structures. And there are other ways, if you think about it, to form a uniform lattice besides a crystal. So there were DNA fibrils where the DNA would line up, and it itself is a lattice, and it itself is a repeating unit. So it has the properties of a crystal, but you could get a diffraction pattern from that. So the early work on DNA structure was actually not done with crystallography. It was done with these long fibrils. It's like these gooey strands, but there was regularity, and you could produce the famous pattern from that. So what's the information? Again, this is the basics, basics, okay? But I've mentioned several times that you have to have a lattice. There has to be order. Here is an incredibly simple molecule in a crystalline lattice. It's water, okay? So here is a ordered array of water molecules, but they have a particular orientation to each other. And inside this, what we call a unit cell, there's a particular orientation to another cell, okay? So a crystalline lattice can maybe take many, many different types of orientations inside a unit cell and how the unit cells relate to each other. So that's a huge part of determining the information here. You have to understand the space group and the unit cell dimensions. You have to know the properties of the crystal in order to deconvolute the information about the molecule that is crystallized. So this is water. I mean, imagine like a folded protein and how crazy that could get. And if you didn't get this basic information, you're not going to get anywhere with the diffraction pattern. Now this one, if you really get into this, you really should read. I'll do my best to simplify it, but it's not a simple concept, and there's a lot of mathematics here. But what's important is the following, that there's what's called the phase problem, okay? And this is a very, very essential part of understanding what information is in the crystal and what does it mean for the structure, okay? And this is this famous analogy where you have a crystal structure, a crystallized duck, and a crystallized cat. Okay, so you know that this is what's in your lattice, and you have a diffraction pattern. And what happens is you have to experimentally determine the phase. Okay, and that's what I'm glossing over a lot here, but let's just say that you have to experimentally determine the phase, because if you don't understand that and you're not correct, your structure is totally wrong. Because you can take the diffraction pattern of, you know, even standing here, this always like flips me around. But it comes down to that you can get a duck structure out of a cat data set, all right? So ducks and cats, who cares? But imagine if this information was wrong and you tried to, you know, figure out the structure of your protein. All right. If you don't have this information properly, your model is meaningless. The structure you come up with is meaningless. And there are many, many different techniques and ways to make sure this is correct, the way that it's derived experimentally. There's a lot of really clever ways to do that so that you get this information correct. So it's one of the most important problems that you have to solve. And sometimes this phasing problem, you get beautiful crystals, everything's right, and you can't crack this problem for some reason, and you don't get your structure. So it can be a massive roadblock. So I presented the phase problem probably poorly, but I think you got the gist. And I've implied something about a structure. It's a model. So what does that mean? Well, it means that all you're getting from the diffraction pattern, if everything's properly done, is a map, is an electron density map, right? Where are the molecules? How are they positioned? Where is that in space? But then you have to know something about what you've crystallized to try to figure out what all that spatial information means, okay? And so this is the model building part, where you get a electron density map, all right? So now this is no longer diffraction anymore. This is all that information about the crystal distilled down to one unit, the actual molecule of interest. And you have to model in there. So here is diffraction, here's an electron density map, and here are side chains of amino acids. There's an aromatic modeled in to the electron density. And so this is the process of you build and refine and test the model. And well, if you've cloned your protein from the beginning, you know the order of amino acids, start to finish, N-terminus to C-terminus. You have the genetics, you understand what's there. So you can start tracing the protein information into your electron density map. And so, you know, for macromolecules, that's really important. You understand what you're crystallizing. So you might have a problem if you were to just start grabbing things at random and making crystals, and how would you, you know, how would you fit things with certainty? That would be a big problem. But starting from defined macromolecules gives you an advantage. You're constrained. It's not any protein on the planet. It's my favorite protein that I overexpressed, you know, 2 years ago, and I finally have my electron density map. But so why is resolution important? Why would you care how much, if you had a 3 angstrom to 1.2 in your electron density map? Well, I hope the answer is obvious from this, because with the proper resolution, now here's where point number one comes up, the distance between carbons. Okay, here's a six-membered ring of carbons. If our resolution, right, isn't even the bond width, it's just a big blob. And you could probably pop in a six-membered ring in there and be fairly confident, but, you know, it's fuzzy. But when you get down to 1.2 angstroms, there's the bond length right there. And there's the big hole right in the middle, okay? There's no question that that's a six-membered ring, and it's modeled perfectly, okay? So high resolution affords much more certainty in your model, right? The structure that you're modeling. So really important, and you'll see this. It's still in the title of most big structure papers. The blah, blah, angstrom map of blah, right? Because that information is key, right? You take much more seriously subatomic resolution than you do, you know, depends on what it is. There's certainly been really exciting 7-angstrom structures published in the top journals. But when you see this reported, ultra high resolution, it speaks to the confidence of the assignment and the structure that emerges. So that information's in there. It might be harder to pull out of big databases, but it's important, right? Information behind the structure. And you might be presented with 5 different structures of the same thing. How do you judge which one's better? Well, maybe you have resolution information, okay, and some other parameters. Because it's a map, it's a model. You're modeling the electron density, so it better be a good model. So what does this afford you in biology? Well, here's a famous structure, a very important structure. This is a histone. A histone surrounded by DNA, okay? One of the functional units of chromatin, okay? So much about biology that we study now, that we're excited about, that we understand. How does DNA work? How is it turned on and off? How do transcription factors work? How does epigenetics function? How can you turn on and off a genome with factors that aren't even encoded in a genome? Well, you know, it can come back to lessons that we learned from a structure like this that really highlighted how certain lysine residues from histones pop out through the DNA, right? And so the interaction of protein and DNA is really, really important. And I keep meaning to check this out, and I just admit that I haven't. I think this is still one of the largest single stretches of DNA that's ever been crystallized, because it was nicely stably wound around the histone, so you have one of the largest crystal structures of DNA still is embedded in this histone. But again, why would resolution be important? Well, in this example, you'd have to sort out the difference between protein and nucleic acid. So you'd better be able to tell the difference between a GC pair or an AT pair, right? So here's at this particular one at 2.8 angstroms, you can tell the difference between these base pairs in the electron density map. So there's the density, there's the base pair. Pretty important. mess up the composition of the ordered base pairs. And then you can see helical structures, and then you can infer this, and you can tell the difference between DNA and protein. So another big famous structure that I hope you're very familiar of is this beast, which was, you know, really a huge achievement. And again, an incredibly complicated crystallography project that took many, 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 many years. But you're left with a diffraction map and a very, very respectably high resolution density map of a mass of protein and nucleic acid that had to be mapped with certainty, and all these positions had to be assembled. And this, of course, is the ribosome. Some of the first images of this structure were actually presented publicly for the first time in this same room. Okay, so it's kind of cool to be here. And it, you know, won Tom and some other people the Nobel Prize for, you know, showing us at atomic resolution this important macromolecule. So all of this work on super exciting, the most important proteins in the world to, you know, many, many other types of proteins are curated and deposited. One of the largest is the protein database. So here's an example of a resource that you might go to for data mining if you wanted to understand something about a class of protein structures, how they move, how they're modeled, right? This is a curated resource. This is a slide that I didn't update. I should, because it's always nice because they, and I meant to do this. You could sort of keep track of how many structures. So a year ago, over a year ago, you had 70,000 structures. But you want to look at how the database is growing and where has the attention of the structural biology community been focused on human proteins, okay, just by the number of structures that are in the database, followed maybe by bacterial proteins. So we have, if you think, so this is important because think of all of biology, all the possible proteins, all the possible structures, all the possible stories. There's a little bit of a bias here in our sampling of structural data in biological space. We know a lot about human proteins. We probably need to know a lot more about proteins in general, but there's no question that we've learned some important themes, that structural motifs are repeated, that the same, that not the same, but very different combinations of amino acids can produce the same structure. So there's a lot of redundancy. So where you might look at this and say, that's too much human data, there's also a lot of information that is going to be the same if you switch species. So that's important. But that's, it's just composition of your database is important in understanding what the biases are. And again, dominated by X-ray data, right? So majority is X-ray, there is NMR, and then everything else. You know, and I'm sure these numbers haven't changed too much. So the EM structures are coming more and more, but not nearly to the density and the rate of X-ray structures. And you know, you can also look at how does the types of information, the types of structures distribute. So individual proteins, individual nucleic acid chains dominate. But then there's more and more emerging complexes, nucleic acids and proteins, okay? But it's still a minority of the structures, but you have, of course, many of these complexes and proteins are sort of, you know, a couple big structures will, you know, quickly inflate the content of this subsection of the database. And I think I forgot to point out one thing. So here's a bias in source of the protein information, okay? Now let's think about the type of protein that's crystallized. And I pointed this out when I talked about hanging drops. Proteins are in aqueous solutions, in salts, and the method of crystallography constrains that. So it is then by technical limitation much more amenable to soluble proteins. But biology is not simply proteins that are perfectly happy in solution, or certainly not in a normal aqueous solution. there's a ton of different biological information in lipid membranes, in membrane proteins, and in different types of biological spaces. And those are still pretty underrepresented. There's a major technical challenge that's still being addressed on how do we get structural information about membrane proteins. And even proteins that have multiple domains, soluble domains, transmembrane domains, and another soluble domain. If you just, and it's fine, and there's been a lot of information if you just shave off the soluble part and get a structure. But we also know that the context is really important, and if you had a receptor, let's say, or a channel that was modulated by intercellular and extracellular domains, but the action of that receptor, the action of that channel is carried out inside a biological membrane, if you don't have that structural information, you don't really know what's going on. So it's still a major challenge, and another limitation in the structure, our structural information. We don't know as much about other types of biological interfaces, membrane interfaces primarily, or more complicated interfaces that aren't like simple globular structures in aqueous solution. So that's another limitation. It's being solved, but again, it's about a pace, you know, what works versus what is challenging. So that's an important, another important feature about this, about these databases. And I listed some useful tools from the simplest to some that are a little bit more sophisticated that it's pretty amazing how quickly you can pull out a structure, manipulate it, highlight it, and think about it. And there's even now, and you may address this directly in this course, ways to take information like this and model it. And I know Mark was very interested in how proteins move and how you could predict and model changes in structure from static structures. So certainly pulling out this information, interacting with it in a meaningful way is important. So are there any questions? I'm going to...